Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Tommy Lee, and you are listening to Rockin' the Floor. Let's go!
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett. And you are listening to another episode of your favorite podcast. As a matter of fact, episode number 181 of Walking the Floor. Goddamn, crazy shit going on this week. Crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, how many episodes? Is that like every episode this year that I kind of start by saying more or less the same thing? Like, wow, it's so nuts. How much crazier could it get? But it got a hell of a lot crazier this week. I'm sure you have heard enough people yammering on and on about the angry mob storming the Capitol and, you know, Trump getting impeached for the second time. And it is just crazy, crazy stuff. I'm not going to talk too much about that because you're probably sick of hearing about it, but I will give you some references to other people talking and writing about it if you're interested in hearing, you know, another take. One of my favorite writers and friend of the show, Matt Stoller, had a great article in The Guardian this week about his sort of hot take about some of the root causes for what's happening in this country. And another friend of the show and one of my favorite writers, Tom Frank, was the guest on the David McWilliams podcast, and I really like his take on it. He is smart and a historian, and just generally one of my favorite people, and I think he really kind of gets it right. And that's about all I'm going to say about that. So go check that out. And we can argue about it later on Twitter, and that'll be great. Woohoo! Yay, America. All right, let's sell some gear. Did you know that Zounds has been around since 1996? And they started way back when as a small little retail shop. Which I was 1996. That must have been like basically before the internet really existed. I mean, it existed, but like, were you on it? I wasn't on it. And now they've grown to become one of the biggest and most badassest online musical instrument retailers on earth. And their entire staff are all musicians. So if you prefer to call, give them a call. Speak to them. They speak the language of rock and roll, the language of music, and they're gonna hook you up. Zounds.com. Get on over there. Treat yourself to something nice, and let's get to this week's interview. Oh man, I spent a lot of time growing up in the early 80s listening to Motley Crue records and staring at the pictures of Motley Crue on their records and in all the magazines I bought and watching them on MTV and all their videos and everything. And you know, really, it's funny because even though, you know, I'm a guitar player, I just always thought Tommy Lee was the coolest guy in the band, you know, just based on like how he looked and acted and the way he played drums. And I mean, for my money, one of the best frickin' rock drummers of all time, Tommy Lee. What a badass motherfucker he is. And was just so much fun to talk to. I was so stoked to get to talk to him. I've met him a few times over the years here and there, but I've never had like a real conversation with him. And he was great. He was like, you know, we talked, of course, a bunch about his new solo record, Andro, which is like more like electronic music, where he does a bunch of, he brought in a bunch of different guest artists to sing and stuff on it. And but he was also totally up for talking about the good old days of the LA rock scene, which, of course, is something that's near and dear to my heart. So here it is. This is Mr. Tommy Lee on Walking the Floor. Hey.
Yo, Chris, what up?
How are you, buddy?
Fucking killer, man. How are you?
I'm freezing my fucking ass off. It's cold today. Jesus.
Are you in LA, right?
I am, yeah. This is cold for LA, man.
I know. It's all windy and crazy. Well,
I know.
Yeah.
Where are you right now? Is that your home studio?
Yeah, I'm in Calabasas.
Oh, nice.
Calabadass.
Well, I feel like, were you guys like kind of on the forefront of turning Calabasas and Westlake into like Hollywood Hills 2.0? I feel like you guys were the first folks to do that, weren't you?
Dude, you know what's crazy is I remember I remember like it was yesterday, although I've been here for 10, 11 years. And I remember moving here and dude, there was no, it was like fucking ghost town.
Right.
There was, you know, there was nobody here. And then I remember the day specifically when Britney Spears moved in. And fucking all of a sudden it was just like
all hell broke loose.
Dude, there was fuck TMZ, and it's just on the, you know, TMZ stands for what, 30 mile zone or whatever the fuck that is. And it's right on the, on the, it's right on the 30 mile borderline of Hollywood or whatever. So all of a sudden they're all here and now going to the store just to go get, you know, some fucking ginger beers and a fucking loaf of bread or whatever. And all the paparazzi people are out there and there's literally helicopters and all this crazy shit. Then Bieber moved in.
Oh shit.
Then fucking J-Lo, Ozzy, dude, I, Stevie Wonder, I saw at like Rite Aid. I'm like, dude, there's Stevie Wonder. This is crazy.
Well, you got some, you got a few years of it all to yourselves. I remember years ago, like in when I first moved to LA in 1990 and I worked at this office out in Woodland Hills. And I remember the Chevron station next door to the office that I worked at. I went in there one day and the guy was like, hey man, Nikki Sixx just came in here and got his car lubed and like showed me, he showed me his check and his check was all like old English. It was badass. I was like, no way.
Oh wow, what a trip.
I know. Well, fuck, let's jump in about your new record, Andro. Tell me about it. Is this something that you did, you make this like during lockdown, or is this something you were already working on?
You know what, it was done by then, thankfully. I had like Motley finished this crazy long couple year tour and New Year's on 2016. So I was like, okay, man, I'm burnt out. Like, I don't want to know about, hear about, think about, do about music. I'm going to take a year off. So I did, I made it about a year, and like around 2017, you know, I don't know, we don't know each other that well, but you probably, you know, you can assume that I'm pretty hyper and I can't quite sit around that long. And so I just had all these
ideas. That's a trait that runs through all drummers, I think.
Right?
And yeah, I'm in a band with two, you know?
I know. So, you know, I mean, I did what I needed to do because I'm never fucking home. You know the drill, right? So I floated around in the pool. I drank excessively. I did absolutely nothing for a year, which was cool. But you know, after that I had just like a plethora of ideas. So I just came down here and I don't think I left for months. And so that's kind of where it all started. And I had it done. It took, I don't know, close to 2 years to get it done, because when you're collaborating with other people, it's always like, okay, you know, it's not like just a band just jumping in and going to do it.
You know,
like, you know, getting somebody to do vocals in the UK and somebody else in Northern California. You know, but with the internet, that made a lot of things a lot easier. You know that.
And who are like a lot of the collaborators on this record?
You know, some you would know, which is cool.
I am so out of touch. It's crazy. That was actually my first impression when I looked at your record. I was like, fuck, I don't know any of these people. I'm like such I live in my own little bubble.
Well, that's cool. Let me educate you with a couple of them. You know, I'm a massive like Underdog fan. And I have this collaboration list of people that I've been following for a while. And, it, you know, like I'll hear something and I'll be like, oh my God, I got to work with this girl. This fucking girl's voice is insane and nobody knows who she is.
Right.
And you know that. There's talent all over the place that no one will probably ever hear. And I love that. Like, I love to like work with people like that. And so, a lot of them you're probably unfamiliar with, like you said, almost all of them, which is fun for me because I've done with Methods of Mayhem. I've specifically went out and went, I'm doing shit with like Kid Rock, Fred Durst, Little Kim, Snoop Dogg, the Wu-Tang Clan, the Crystal Method. Like I just went and did and worked with all these people again that I wanted to work with. This one was more of like I want to turn some people on to some shit that they may or may not have heard of. And that was sort of my inspiration was, you know, not only wanting to collaborate with these people who I adore their fucking work. I wanted to turn people on to some new shit.
So that's interesting. So would you work up a track in your studio and then send it to somebody in some far off location? Like, I'm curious if there was any you know, creative struggle with that. Like, did you ever get anything back from people that you're like, yeah, that's not really what I'm thinking. Could you try again?
Yeah, interesting.
Take another swing at that.
Yeah, that's a great question because, yes, and you are correct. I'd have a track pretty much done. And in my mind, I'd be like, oh my God, so-and-so would fucking murder this track. This is a done deal. And that's kind of the process. And I would reach out to them and send them the track and, you know, they would hear it and be like, oh my God, yes, of course. And then, you know, a day or two later, we'd be either here or, you know, for instance, a couple of the collaborators are from the UK. They would do the, you know, their parts there. And then I would get it and, finish producing it here. Dude, I got to tell you this story. There's one really fucking amazing story. And you'll appreciate this. I don't know if anyone else will, because it never happens. It's one of those. There's a track on the record called Make It Back. And there's this girl, her name is Julia. She's in a group called Playa. And forever I've wanted to work with this girl. She has this crazy voice. Anyway, I got this track done and I send it to her and she's like, oh my God, yes, I'd love to do it. Okay, cool. Crazy that they were actually in LA. She comes over and mind you, a lot of times when I'm working on a track, I'll take like, you know, just some a random acapella and I'll chop the shit out of it and kind of place it and make it sound like what I'm hearing melodically.
Right.
So I did that. And so she comes over and I'm like, hey, because I sent her a version with no vocal. But I wanted her to hear the melody. And she's like, no, I don't want to hear that. Please don't play it to me. I don't want to be influenced by that. And I said, fair enough. I get it. I want you just to do your thing. Dude, she goes out into the fucking, to the live room. She starts to sing and I'm sitting there looking at my engineer, Smiley. And Smiley knows, we both heard it because I've been working on it.
Sure.
We both look at each other and go, she's singing, dude, she's literally singing 97-98% exactly what I Frankensteined in there just as a rough.
Were you like, who leaked you this demo?
That's it, dude. I was like, there's no way this can happen. Like,
right.
Either that or we're on the exact, you know, melodic plane here because
it was meant to be.
Yeah, it was goosebumps and one of those moments that'll, man, I hope it happens again, but they rarely, if ever, happen. So,
you know, when you're working on your more like electronic, like EDM or whatever, techno kind of stuff that you do,
yeah,
considering your drumming ability or just, you know, the fact that you're a drummer, do you go in and record live drums and then manipulate it and fuck it up? Like, is that what I'm hearing in the drum track or are you programming drums or both? Or, you know what I mean? Like, how do you sort of figure that out?
Yeah, it's kind of both for me. Like I have obviously an acoustic kit out there for the more big bombastic sections. And I have an electronic kit. sometimes it's weird. Like, I don't really have a method, like, depending on what the track is wanting, I'll either program it by hand, I'll play it electronically just so I have all the MIDI information, and then I'll change the sounds, or I'll just go in and smash some real drums in sections that warrant that. So I kind of go, like, the music sort of dictates, or the beat dictates where, you know, I take it sonically, you know, and sonically I mean by whether it's, you know, super tight or super big bottom end stuff that just doesn't come from an acoustic drum set. It's sure. just impossible.
Yeah.
You can't get, you know, 60, 40 hertz out of a fucking acoustic bass drum. It just doesn't happen. So that'll kind of, the song usually dictates, or the beat that, that is there usually dictates it. For instance, there's a song on the record called Tops, and I always wanted to do this. And I was like, I want a song to have no instruments, I want the whole song just beat driven, and I want the drums to play the melody. So if you listen to that track, the melody is played by the drums. It's some big 808s just going boom ba tuk boom da boom 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 ba boom ba oom ba oom da oom oom oom, and there's not one fucking instrument in the whole track. And this girl, Push, she's a South African vocalist slash rapper, whatever you want to call it. I just call, everyone's a vocalist. I don't care what the style is. And she came in and just murdered it, and super sexy, but there's not one fucking instrument on that track. I wanted to make a song where the drums played the music.
Right. That's cool. You know, I was messing around with my little studio setup here a while ago, just during the lockdown, you know, writing songs and trying to figure out how Logic works and all that stuff. And I stumbled upon a vocoder plugin I have. And then I accidentally stuck it on the drum track, and it was like, it's just all of a sudden started doing all this like melodic stuff. Basically, it was crazy. You know, it's like, never thought of that before,
man. There's nothing better than those happy accidents, right?
Yeah.
This really shouldn't be going through this and into this.
Yeah.
But fuck, it's cool.
It's not supposed to be used this way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's okay.
And the beauty of that is that, man, when that inspires that leads to some other idea, dude, you just, I don't know, that some magic just happened there.
It's
because
the magic,
you're doing shit that you would not normally, or you're not supposed to do.
Now, were you planning on like touring? Are you going to tour this record when sort of the touring world comes back online?
Man, you know, I wanted to, and I thought, you know, during this time especially, like, it would be cool to, you know, maybe just do, I learned my lesson with Methods of Mayhem. I tried to tour that, and that was just almost impossible, because there's no way I could get George Clinton, Snoop Dogg, and this, I couldn't, there's no way I could get those guys to commit to a fucking 6-month tour.
Right.
So I would get them to show up in the cities that, you know, where they were from. But I learned my lesson. I was out of my mind to think that could even happen. So this time around, I thought, well, maybe instead of trying to go do this, like, do a proper tour, why don't I just pick, like, I don't know, I'm sure I could get everybody to commit to, let's say, 10 days. Let's just go do 7 of the major cities.
Yeah.
And then with the pandemic, I was like, well, fuck, that's not going to happen. Okay, I'm going to just get everybody to commit to 1 day, and let's just, like, maybe just do like a live thing. And I thought about that, and the more I kind of looked around and watched what people were doing, man, I don't know, dude, music, and especially the stuff that's on Andro, it's more of an indoor sport than something you know what I'm saying? Like, it requires like big fucking sound, and like, it's shit that you feel. It's beat music. And you can't it just doesn't come across over the two little shitty speakers on your laptop or your even your home theater. Like,
yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know. It's just, you know, you got to be there and it's got to be fucking smashing you.
Yeah.
So I just opted out on that because I saw way too many do it and come up short. And I was like, nah, I'm just going to just let the record live on, you know, just let it live.
I'm curious, and I ask this question as somebody that makes like solo records and sideband records that lean a little like country fried, you know, and I go out on do little bar tours and bring my buddy to play a pedal steel or what, you know, and it's like, and it's a different genre than what anybody would know me for, kind of thing. So I'm curious, like, you know, and I've grown used to over the years that there's always going to be a certain amount of like the dude with the Nirvana shirt on looking at me like, what the fuck is this dude playing this pussy music for?
Whatever,
you know, it's just reality. So I'm wondering, like, if you get like with the stuff you do outside of Motley Crue that ventures away from rock music, you know, in the traditional sense, you know, if you get, you know, how your fans sort of accept it or don't, and whether or not you give a shit, you know?
Dude, that's such a great question because, yes, I get a ton of, and here's a classic one. I don't typically read like comments when people, you know, post comments on shit. I learned a long time ago, it really doesn't fucking matter at the end of the day. Like, sure. Are you happy with what you made and, you know, whatever with that. So anyway, my manager, he's like, man, dude, you got to read some of the comments. They're fucking great. And I was like, I don't know. So what do I do? Okay. I did this fucking amazing collaboration with Post Malone. You know who he is,
sure. Right?
Post Malone and Tyler Yahweh. And they did this song called Tommy Lee. And I was like, that's fucking insane. Post Malone's probably one of the biggest artists out there other than Billie Eilish right now. And I was honored, and they did this amazing track, and they asked me if I would remix it. And I said, hold on, let me think about it. Okay. So I smashed drums on it. John 5 played guitars. I put my sort of remix spin on it, and we made this banger out of it. And we shot a video of us tracking it here and stuff. And I'm reading the comments, and here's to answer your question. I get there and everyone's like, this is fucking rad. This is dope. And then you have the fucking guy who's going, well, this doesn't sound like Motley Crue. And I'm like, it's how the fuck would it ever sound like Motley Crue?
Yeah.
Post Malone.
It's not Motley Crue.
There's nobody in Motley Crue here but me. And it's just me. It's not the four of us, yeah. Dude.
Well, that's a really funny thing though that you're touching on, because you can post something on your Instagram, whatever, and you can get, you know, 100 people going like, yay, that's great. And then the one guy that's like, fuck you, you suck. That's the one that gets you, you know?
Yeah. And I'm like, that's it. I'm never reading comments again. Fuck that guy. I mean, it just blows my mind how people sometimes, let me take that back. But a lot of people, a lot of the times, I just don't, maybe it's just me. Is everybody, it can't be everybody. God, it can't be. Is, you know, are most people just not that fucking smart? Like, what would prompt you to say something like that? There's no evidence of it being Motley Crue. You know what I mean? So right, yes, to answer your question, I get that. But then again, I do get a lot of people that know exactly what they're going to get when I do my own thing, because I even put that out there in a big way during Motley shows. I mean, when it comes time for my fucking crazy drum solo shit, man, I'm throwing shit at people. And I'm talking about some serious rock fans, right, that are like, you know, you know, I'm throwing them some shit they've never heard, and some fucking Sonics that are just like, what the fuck is this? And you look over and their chick is fucking dancing to it going, yeah, this is dope. So I think people know that when I do my own thing, I just go and I do what I love. And so some people it's expected and others are still, you know, don't want me to do anything outside of fucking of rock.
Right. Like, right. You know, in light of Eddie Van Halen passing away recently, I read that. Yeah. I don't know if you ever read that book about the early days of Van Halen called Rising. It's fucking so cool. It's sort of their story from like childhood up until pretty much the first album tour. It sort of ends there. So it's all playing keg parties and trying to break into club scene in Hollywood and all that stuff. And it struck me that there was like a real parallel in their story with Motley Crue's story, even though like I would think of you guys as coming maybe in the next wave of LA rock stuff.
Yeah.
But a similar parallel in like no one in the music industry believed in them. You know, like they were told like to their face, like you have no commercial potential and you're never going to go anywhere, all that sort of stuff. And yet they were this band selling out like the Pasadena Civic Center or whatever, you know, people. It's similar to like what, like the track that you guys run. So I'm wondering, like, were you guys aware of them and their story and their path? And was that an influence on the early days? Because you think about early days of Motley Crue, like you guys had to put up, like make self-finance your own first record and put it out yourself, all that stuff before the business figured it out.
Yes, it was very similar. And I remember, I grew up in a town called Covina, which is just a few minutes from Pasadena where they were from. And I remember them, and there was this band that was kind of like them called Wolfgang.
Oh, that's funny, considering Eddie's son's name.
I know, which is bizarre, right? And I remember that, and I remember them being these guys from Pasadena and the struggle, and it was very similar for us, man. And you know, they were influential because especially when they broke, fuck, it was like, oh my God, these guys, they're like fucking 15 minutes from us. They did it. Like, this is crazy. And
plus in the context of the times when they when the sort of the mood was like, oh no, new wave and punk is making rock music extinct. And that whole thing that was, you know what I mean? Like, which I imagine you guys must've dealt with the same issue. Yeah.
That was the exact, that was the time. This was like, you have to picture, this was when the biggest popular shit was meant like the Skinny Ties and like My Sharona, the Knack, like boom, doo, da,
da, doo, right, da, right. Da, da.
And so bands like Motley Crue and Van Halen were like, what the fuck is this? Like nobody, it was so not the thing, or it just wasn't cool, but yet it was weird enough to get people's attention. It was a weird, super weird time, and how, you know, a few of the bands we're talking about came through that, I still have no idea, because that was not the thing.
It's interesting because that time is never, like, I remember when like alt rock and indie rock and stuff first started really becoming a big commercial thing, that there was a lot of talk about like indie label this and indie label that and indie label culture. But the early LA metal stuff never gets discussed in that conversation, when to my memory, including Motley Crue with Leather Records, but all the stuff that I was listening to first came out on like Shrapnel Records and weird little indie labels and all those bands like Keel and all that stuff. Like it was all indie.
Yeah.
Before there was this thing called indie, and like it doesn't get the indie cred of what came after it, you know?
That's so interesting, man. And you know, when I do think about that, I think that maybe, and I really believe this because I've seen it happen several times. I think we may have been right on that verge of that mark. Every 10 years music does a fucking, and it's a beautiful thing. God bless that happening, because otherwise music would be pretty fucking boring. And you guys were a part of that swift. Like, yeah, every 10 years, I remember seeing it, and we were right around that knack, you know, Jesus Christ. Who were the, we got the beat.
Oh, Go-Go's, yeah, yeah.
Like, this was a time when that shit was big as fuck. And then there was this big shift. And then 10 years later, there was that other shift where it was fucking Nirvana, where it was fucking Soundgarden, STP. Like, and I was, and I welcomed that so much. I was like, yes, thank God somebody's doing fucking something different. Because if I hear another band trying to sound like us or do something similar, you know, I'm going to fucking, you know, and I loved what we did, but I really, really loved those every 10 years, how music just kind of does this upheaval and goes like, what, here's some new shit. And you were a part of that.
Regenerates. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've seen this happen, dude. And I've been doing this with Motley, like close to, like, I don't know, we're in another year or two, it'll be 40 years. So I've seen this happen four times. So,
right.
It's interesting, and I love it. I love that music changes like that, man.
I mean, wait, can you talk a little bit about that, those early days in the LA rock scene? Like, I was a little too young to see you guys in the club, so I started going to shows a lot, like, 83, 84. And I grew up in Santa Barbara, so I was coming down to see gigs at, like, the Country Club and Troubadour and all that stuff.
Oh, my God, the Country Club, dude.
The Country Club was so – the Country Club was the closest club to Santa Barbara, like, yes. Where you could go see those bands. So we went to the Country Club a lot. But it's interesting because my memory of it was, you know, seeing all those bands before they had record deals, and those shows were always packed. You know, like, and then a little later on, it became like Jet Boy and Faster Pussycat and LA Guns and all that. And those shows were always packed. And then yeah. I moved to LA in 90 and there was like no scene. It was dead. So I'm curious, like, there used to be such a strong LA rock and roll scene. It kind of died there by the late 80s. But can you talk a little bit about that? Like what it was like? And the reason I was bringing this up is because I just saw that Rat video the other day on TV that you guys are dressed up as cops in, and, like, you know, Ozzy's in it and everybody. I remember being a kid thinking, oh, that's so amazing. Like, all those guys hang out. Like, was there camaraderie in the scene here amongst all the sort of like-minded bands? And what was that like?
Yeah, you know what? It was like that. We all hung out. We all hung out all the time. That's just what we did. We kind of just, we went clubbing together. We played shows together. It was a really different scene, man. It's so different than now. And maybe the, you know, the stuff that you saw where, maybe, you know, once that scene evolved and people started going on fucking major tours and leaving, it just left here. You know, maybe that was part of the void. I don't know. That one's kind of hard because I feel like I wasn't here for that. By that time, we were gone out of here.
Yeah, sure. It's funny. I always think about that. By the time I moved here, it's like, I'm ready. And then there was like no scene.
Where's everybody?
where everybody go, man? These fucking shows used to be packed. Now I'm playing at the Coconut Teaser to nobody on like a Tuesday.
Oh, fuck. Oh, my God. God, wow. Thanks for bringing back the Country Club memories, because you're right. That was the spot. And what a fucking dope club that was.
Totally.
Woo. Banging sound. Big. You could smash a lot of people in.
I loved going to those shows back then, because when you went to go see, you know, you'd go see whatever, Armored Saint or something, and you'd see like the guitar player from Keel and like the singer from Malice and like the other local, like, oh, no way, there's Rick Fox from fucking Stanford, fuck yeah, you know, and all that shit. You know? And I remember there's that guy that used to sell like photos out front, like it's just some local photographers. So you could like buy some, like a picture of Yngwie or what, you know, like what the fuck, you know, like. That was cool.
God,
cool
dude.
Scene.
You're bringing it back, bro.
I mean, tell me, with the Motley Crue movie that came out a little while back, like, did you feel like, did they do a good job with that? Were you guys involved in that? And, like, did you feel like they represented the era, like, you know, like that came across kind of in some, you know, of course it's a Hollywood version, so it's not going to be the real thing, but did you, were you happy with it?
Dude, you know what? All of us couldn't be happier. It's funny because when we were kind of not auditioning, but like meeting with different directors, I remember, cause that was really important. Like who is going to tell the story? Because we all know, and you've seen them, there are some pretty shitty rock movies out there.
Sure.
I won't mention any names.
They never get the details right. They just say, it rankles me as a kid who is so obsessed with it all. I'm like, that's the wrong haircut and the wrong guitar.
Yeah. You know? That shit never happened. What is this?
Right.
It's not right.
Yeah.
You want to get in there and start fucking, no.
Yeah.
So that was the most crucial, was finding the right director. Who's gonna fucking tell the story? Because this is an insane story to tell. So we're meeting with directors, and Jeff Tremaine comes up, and we're like, we literally went into that meeting going like, the guy from Jackass? That directed the Jackasses? And like, we're like, look, this isn't a fucking comedy. This is not the guy. That's how we went into the meeting. Nikki and I went and we met with him, and come to find out, Jeff is a fucking massive Motley fan. He grew up in that time. He's like, I'm the only fucking guy on this planet that can direct this movie. There is nobody else. I'm going to take everybody back to that time period via, you know, the story and the phones and the cars and the clothes and I'm going to bring people right back to that. I want people to experience it, especially for a lot of young people who never got to experience it. I'm going to bring them there. And we were like, wow, this is interesting. We were still super apprehensive, but man, we made the right choice because he did exactly that. And, you know, from the casting and just all the details and how in the world he smashed 20-something years into an hour and 45 minutes is beyond me. And have it be, you know, have it make sense. You know what I mean? Because it could end up being just a bunch of crazy stories. But he made it work in an incredible way. And it's so true and raw and honest. He nailed it, man. We couldn't have been happier.
Did you like call up Machine Gun Kelly and be like, come out to my house. I'm going to give you Tommy Lee lessons. I'm going to explain to you how to do it.
It's crazy, dude, because I've known him for a while, and I just get a call one day. He's like, dude, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, what? He goes, dude, I'm playing you in the movie. I was like, what? And immediately it made sense because we're the same lanky, fucking kind of hyper weird dude. And he goes, I got the script. I'm coming over. I want to know. Like, he was so dedicated to it, along with the other boys.
I thought physically he most like looked like, you know, he became you in that movie.
Identically. And we're so much alike as it is, but his dedication was just incredible. I've never seen anybody go like, I'm going to fucking nail this. I'm going to make you proud. And I want to go through this line by line. And I want to know exactly, like, did it happen like this? Did it, if it didn't, how did it happen? Like, and then the guy went out and took like 4 months of like drum lessons, learning all my shit, like the twirls and the bouncing the sticks off the drums, and just, I mean, that shit takes years. Like, and I couldn't believe it, man. Like, he went for it.
You know, it's interesting. Speaking about your drumming, you know, I wanted to ask you about this on a musical level. Like, that era obviously is remembered for like spandex and big hair and everybody overplaying all the time and all that stuff. But you were a particularly like tasteful drummer. in an era that isn't necessarily remembered that way, where like, I feel like, and this is something I never thought about until I started playing with Dave Grohl, like where Dave always thinks about drum parts in terms of like hooks and parts. And,
yes.
You know, like, and you had that in your drumming on those early records for sure. And I'm wondering if that was like, was that intentional or is that something you just kind of naturally fell into? Just, I'm thinking things like, just stuff like the little cymbal hit in Live Wire, you know, like that kind of stuff that like, whereas maybe somebody else would have gone, you know what I mean?
It's
just a different approach. You know, was that something that you just fell into or were you trying to create hooks?
I guess, you know, like Dave, I mean, I write music too. So in my playing, I'm always, you know, I think melodically and like, you know, and it is a conscious effort because, you know, I think of, you know, parts and how do we get from here to here and still make it feel cool, without it being disruptive and, you know, and I was inspired and influenced by a lot of simple drummers, great drummers, but really simple. Like
who are you guys?
But like Bonham, for his super heavy foot, the groove, always the late snare drum that just keeps everything, because guitar players always sort of rush, but that late snare drum just keeps it feeling really cool. And of course the big foot, Phil Rudd, AC/DC, the guy might as well be a fucking metronome, just
So,
and then you've got like one of my other influences was Tommy Aldrich on the showy level, you know, to make things, something simple, look cooler than it is.
Right.
And like with the, like a lot of those things, I think of like, okay, like what you were saying with like the cymbal grabs, you know, like, I mean, I'll edit that stuff in sometimes because it's a way to go to stop something and then go into the next section. Yeah. So physically you would do it like that, or you would take a cymbal crash and flip it upside down and it would into the next section. So I play more musically than like, I guess like a drummer would, who would just like put fills in all over the place. And
right.
I think, and you know, probably because I play guitar and piano and write music, I just approach the drums sort of the same way. You know, how can I make it musical instead of just smashing through it?
And like, how collaborative were those early crew records, like putting the songs together? I imagine like the first record must have been on a shoestring budget and recorded fast, but like, you know, what was that like when you guys were getting it together in the studio?
You know, it would be, you know, I would bring in a piano riff or a guitar riff. Mick would bring in a guitar riff. Nikki would bring in, you know, a riff, or the guy's always just fucking spitting lyrics out constantly. He's just a wordsmith. So it was a collaborative effort basically with the three of us. Vince really didn't write, so you'd have the three of us and Vince wouldn't even be there a lot of times, and I would sing like on the Motley demos, like for instance on Girls, you know, I'd bring in like a demo of it kind of done. Not done, but like enough for us to all kind of dogpile on it,
right,
and make it fucking,
to hear that there was something there to build off. Yeah.
I'd bring in like, you know, something to start the party. And
right.
And so that's kind of pretty much how it would work. And then, you know, and then when it would come time to, you know, once it's written and demoed and we record, then since fucking forever ago, I've always been that guy who's like, just, you know, how do we make it sound better sonically? Like,
right.
You know, and I started injecting electronics into reinforcing the drum sound so it was bigger. and the bass, you know, like how do we put some sub bass underneath the electric bass, you know, some, those frequencies that don't happen through a, you know, an Ampeg amp and a bass, like,
right.
It just, that stuff doesn't happen. Those are called sine waves. I would sit there with the engineer and producer a lot of times and just be your typical tweaker, you know, trying to make it sound as dope as we can make it sound. Right. You know,
it's interesting because, you know, obviously over the years with success comes bigger budgets and, you know, more time in the studio and getting known, and then recording technology changes and all that shit. I'm wondering, do you ever listen to that first crew record, which is like, most music I listen to now, I listen to with like earbuds when I'm jogging or something. So I hear I hear everything in like headphone terms. Like, and that record in particular is so crazy raw, you know?
Oh my God.
But like, are you ever tempted, like, let's go in and make a fucking, like, just bang it out in 3 fucking days and everybody gets one track and fucking let's hit it.
that would be fun. That would be fun to do, man. Like, I know, really, like, everybody gets spoiled after a while. It's like, you know, like, fuck you, I don't know, like, you're right, the first record we literally went into a room and we're like, go. and that's it. There's no like coming back and like, okay, now today's guitar day, we're gonna do all the guitars. We're just gonna get the drums today.
We're gonna spend 4 days working out this snare sound.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, because you want the snare drum to be in tune with the track and the bass. I get all that stuff, but when we didn't know that stuff, we just fucking went for it. It didn't matter.
Yeah, totally.
And it would be really cool to just do that again and just see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
It'd be a fun experiment, wouldn't it?
Totally.
Let's do it.
I'm in, man. Let's fucking go do that tomorrow.
Yeah.
We just have to write a bunch of songs. As good as Livewire. Damn.
Tell Dave I said hi, man. I haven't seen him in a minute.
You know, I wanted to ask you, I remember Dave telling me a story about how when Nirvana first ended, there was a moment there, like he went, it was right about the same time, I think, that Stan Lynch had left the Heartbreakers, and Dave went and played with Tom Petty and played on SNL with Tom Petty. And I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, maybe Petty offered him the gig or something. And I'm wondering if you ever had any kind of similar experience. Like, did you ever think about, like, when Motley Crue first broke up? And I don't even remember actually if Motley Crue technically broke up or not. It just kind of went inactive for a while. But like, in, let's say in the 90s after the Karabi album, were you ever tempted to go join some other big established band? Did anything like that ever come up?
Nothing like that really ever came up. I know that I got a chance to play on Nine Inch Nails track, and I always thought, like, fuck, man, it'd be cool to play, you know, I thought maybe at some point that would that might take off into something else, but I was still in Motley at that time, so that would have never happened. But during the time where I left Motley for like 5 years, I fucking went to jail, and I gotta get out of Motley for a minute and just, I need to get my shit together. That's a whole nother story. But in that time, and that's when I got inspired to do Methods of Mayhem and do my own thing, because I really just needed a massive change in my whole musical world. But that's never happened, man. I never thought about it or was never approached to do anything other than Motley. And maybe that's because, you know, nobody wanted me to, or.
I find that hard to believe, sir.
Yeah.
Or something tells me you could have had your pick.
Yeah. Or they're just like, he's in Motley. He's never going to do that. I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, rock and roll makes funny pairings sometimes. I mean, I remember hearing like Eddie Van Halen jammed with Limp Bizkit or something. Well, you know, so you just hear about some of these crazy pairings. I didn't know if like you ever like sat in with the Stones or, you know, just who knows, you know, some crazy. Yeah.
I did have a chance, dude. And this is a fucking one. This is one of those moments where I'm one of my, along with Cheap Trick and Van Halen and Aerosmith and Zeppelin, like all these bands that I grew up with that I love. I got a fucking chance, dude, to play with Aerosmith, and they don't let anybody fucking sit in. Nobody. And it was my birthday and we were on tour with them. I'm like, dude, I go up to Steven Tyler and I'm like, dude, fuck. I would absolutely shoot my mother in the back to play with you guys. No, I'm just kidding.
Last time I saw Aerosmith, they wouldn't even let Joey Kramer play with them. So, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those. And Steven goes, he looked at me like he wanted me to, but he goes, well, you're going to have to ask Joey because Joey doesn't let anybody come up and jam with us. And I was like, okay. So I went and talked to Joey and I literally begged him. I said, dude, it's my birthday. Please, please, please. Can I just fucking play one song? It was my favorite song. And he was like, and I'm dying while he just kind of looks around the room and finally he goes, okay. And I was like, dude, fuck.
What was the song?
It was Back in the Saddle.
Oh, there you go.
No. Last Child.
Oh, yeah. Okay, killer. Yeah.
Dude, I was just like, I think I may have had a little poo-poo in my pants. I don't know. But it was that moment, and Tyler's like, Tyler's got the mic and he's leaning over the drums behind me. I was like, dude, I could die right now. I'm good.
Yeah. Somebody take a picture. What I know Crew was supposed to do some dates this past summer that obviously got thwarted by COVID, but what's next? Like, what do you got going on when the world comes back online?
When the world comes back. Well, dude, it's crazy because in 2016, that was it for us. We were like that. We want to go out on top and go out on a super cool, you know, like we're out. That was rad. Thank you guys. And not be like a few of our, you know, musical peers who are playing country fairs. And we were like, that's just not the way we visualize going out. Let's just go out right now, this at the fucking peak, and just let's bounce. So we decided we're not going to ever play together. We may make music together, but no more touring. So and then fucking a couple years later, what is it, fuck, like last year Live Nation comes to us with a fucking just insane offer that we can't possibly refuse, and it's a stadium tour. We've never done a stadium tour. We were all like, well, fuck, we said we'd never do this, and fuck, it's stadiums. Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. And dude, so we said yes, and they put tickets on sale, and the fucking stadium tour sells out, and what? Like, I can't even believe that's happening. And so, and then COVID happens, and it's, so now, anyway, to answer your question, it has been pushed back to hopefully same time, but next year or so.
Right. I think
June 7th, it was slotted to go out. And so hopefully if things are back together, maybe we get it going in next June.
Well, a farewell tour is a great setup for the 40th anniversary stadium tour. That's what I say.
I guess. Because that's the last thing we even signed like a cessation of touring or whatever you fucking call that. We're like, because we didn't, or never ever wanted to be that band that says this is it and then comes back and does four more farewell tours like the Stones and Kiss, and I can name a fucking handful. Sure. We're like, we don't want to be those guys. That's it. We're done. And then an offer like that comes to for something that you guys have never done as a band. You're like, fucking stadiums? Okay, let's make that the last one.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, I mean, fuck.
Hey, makes sense to me, brother.
It wasn't just your, you know, let's just go do another tour.
Yeah.
This is a big deal, and we all said yes. So hopefully we'll get to do that, man, next year or sometime when everything's cool.
Well, I can't wait to see it, man. And thanks a million for sitting down and talking to me today. It's been a real pleasure, dude.
Oh, it was cool catching up with you, man.
For sure.
Good to see you. You look happy, healthy, and
same.
All righty, boys and girls. That was Tommy fucking Lee from Motley Crue on Walking the Floor. Go give his latest record, Andro, a spin. And we'll be back in a couple weeks with a new president and a new episode. So take care of yourself until then. And we'll see you soon. Adios, amigos!